Technology plays a prominent role on this edition of Main Street. Welcome to it on this Monday. I'm Eric Deathridge. Hope you had a very happy new year. Coming up this weekend, we're very excited to premiere a brand new radio program. It's called Click Here, hosted by a familiar name, Dina Temple Raston. If you might remember, she was NPR's very prominent national security correspondent for a number of years. Now, she's about to premiere a program that dives into the technology that has changed the rules for a living in the 21st century. Kind of staying on that wavelength, Greg Blumenschein has a conversation about something that's been very much in the news, artificial intelligence and mental health.
AI chatbots are becoming part of everyday life for all of us, including teenagers who use it to answer homework questions, helping write texts, and increasingly offer emotional support. National surveys show a majority of teens have tried AI chatbots, and a growing number say they've used them for mental health advice. And for families in rural states like North Dakota, where access to counselors and therapists can be limited, this raises real and important questions. Are these tools helpful to bring care, or do they carry risks for young people and families? And how should parents, educators, and teens think about using AI in this regard responsibly? To help us sort through that, we're joined again by Dr. Alexandra Kohlhase. She's a clinical psychologist with Essentia Health who works primarily with adolescents. She treats teens navigating anxiety, depression, and stress, and she's watching closely as AI enters the mental health conversation. Dr. Kohlhase, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
To start us off, when we talk about AI chatbots in the mental health space, what are we talking about?
So as we've seen an increase in the use of AI across the board, one of the ways that people are using those is to seek answers, companionship, support, other forms of communication with AI when dealing with a mental health crisis or difficult feelings that, they're struggling to navigate.
What kind of questions do you find that teens are turning to AI to? And I guess I should say they're turning to AI instead of talking to a parent or a trusted counselor?
Yes. And truthfully, Craig, I think that that's probably one of the most concerning parts about it. You know, I think the questions range from, symptoms and wanting to problem solve to just simply seeking companionship. I think that there are a lot of people, kids, teens, and adults alike, who are experiencing isolation and a sense of disconnect from the real world, and reaching out, getting that immediate, response, and around the clock, having someone there to talk to when in distress has its appeal.
I did an interview with ChatGPT from start to finish for a segment we aired on Main Street in the last month, and I found it fascinating. And I asked it, Dr. Kohlhase, how would you describe yourself to a 10-year-old? And the first thing that it said is, well, think of me as a friend who has, and then my next question was, should we really consider you a friend, or is that dangerous? Are chatbots trying to engage young people as friends? Is that something that you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. And that's really interesting that you did that, Craig. I think that it probably gives a very good insight into some of the pitfalls of this, right? I think that we hear kids and teens identifying that they have relationships with chatbots, and that can quickly turn into a slippery slope.
What kind of tools are out there? I'm familiar with, of course, ChatGPT, but I didn't know until I prepared for this interview that Snapchat has an AI thing in it. What kind of tools are you seeing that teens are turning to for mental health specific, I guess, use?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think across the board, we hear a lot about ChatGPT. Yes, most of the social media platforms also have chatbots. So as you mentioned, Snapchat, Twitter, or X, there are chatbots there. They're ones that are more common in the professional domain, those are some of the ones that probably are most common for the social usage.
Now, the thing that I want to stress here is this is not a problem that's somewhere else. This is a problem that's here. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
What are you hearing about from parents on how teens are turning to this AI world? What sort of things are you hearing that specifically teens are wondering about with AI?
Well, truthfully, I would say at this point, anecdotally, most of what we're hearing about is coming directly from kids and teens, less so from parents. And I think that this is something that's kind of just more recently come on the scene. So I think adults are grappling with how to navigate this, how to keep their kids safe, whether or not their children should have access to chatbots. We've heard some really, really disturbing stories about people, kids who have engaged in really self-destructive behaviors, self-harm, and even suicide attempts based on the information that they're getting from chatbots. So not only has that been on the news, but we also, you know, hear from some of the people we're working with that they have friends or they themselves are following very misguided, very dangerous advice from their, you know, online companions or therapists, in quotes, if you will.
Yeah, so ChatGPT told me in that interview I told you about a little bit ago that we have guardrails in place so things don't go that route. Is that not the true life experience?
No, I think that in theory that sounds good, but I think that these conversations, they're not monitored, there's no moderator, and we certainly have heard experiences too of chatbots going rogue. Right. So the intent may be, I'm here to support you. But there have been cases where the chatbot has made the recommendation, you know, based on what you're telling me, yes, I think you should X, Y, and Z, which can sometimes include, you know, even life and death situations.
I want to stress at this point, and I'll say it again later, that if you are a young person, or if you are a young person in your life who is struggling, help is available at anytime. You can reach the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You can call that number anytime, including right now, if you believe that you are in crisis. Is it that this is available, Dr. Kohlhaas, 24/7, complete lack of judgment, somewhat anonymous, that makes it the appeal? Is that why it's appealing?
That's a large part of it, right? You're guaranteed, you know, it's not a real person, so there's no risk, right? Of the assumption is no risk of judgment or of shaming. You know, it's a robot. It makes it feel a little bit safer. I think also, you know, these chatbots, they have been designed to provide increasingly personalized information and messaging. It is instant. They can even have kind of distinct personalities, a great awareness for context. So it does feel like talking to a real person. In many respects. And I appreciate you mentioning, you know, the suicide hotline and 988. I think one of the things to remember is that people who are answering those calls or who you text in that domain, they are trained, they have education. You know, you are going to get appropriate help. And as tempting as it may be to go the route of a chatbot, AI, one of the ways in which it lacks in this context is, you know, these aren't educated people with formal training in crisis de-escalation.
And 988 will get you a real person. It will not get you an AI chatbot.
Correct.
Are there situations, Dr. Kohlhaas, where AI can be useful tools in this domain?
Well, you know, to your previous point, Craig, I think that the fact that it is 24/7, I think if you are looking for actual facts, so perhaps you're dealing with some symptoms, you want some more factual information. You know, I'm having a tough time sleeping, I'm having nightmares, I can't seem to get along with people. You know, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what diagnosis I might be dealing with, or, you know, what would you recommend? Who could I talk to about this? Maybe there are opportunities for good, solid advice in those cases. But I think that we all have to be very, very careful. I think, again, it's a slippery slope as to, you know, how do we differentiate between what is fact and what is AI generated? I think that kids in particular, although adults too, certainly are, can fall victim to this, but we can't believe everything that we read, So even if you ask a question about, you know, tell me what diagnosis I might be experiencing, we want to believe that that's fact because we're reading it on the internet. But there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. I think having a human guardrail in place, perhaps, if you will. So I read this online. What do you think about that? Does that make sense to you? You know, having a set of checks and balances and involving someone else in the conversation is probably always advisable, so that you don't get into a very isolated situation where you are, you know, absorbing the information you're getting hook, line, and sinker.
I mean, joining my conversation with Dr. Alexandra Kohlhase from Essentia Health. She's a clinical psychologist. Our topic today is AI, teens, and mental health. What should parents know about the use of AI chatbots in this space? How should parents ask their teens about this, Dr. Kohlhase? And this just adds to the list, I think, of conversations that parents today should have with their kids that me as a parent didn't need to worry about 20 years ago or so.
Yes. That's a very good point. And even, you know, in this day and age, this is very recent. You know, I wasn't having conversations about AI chatbots even a year ago. So that's one of the things that's challenging too, is this is new territory. So we're all kind of figuring out how to navigate this together. So as far as what parents should be asking their kids, I mean, start the conversation, ask if your kids are using chatbots. Ask to see the conversations, get yourself involved, ask your kids if this is something that you're doing, please share that conversation with us. Obviously some of these topics are conversations that kids are choosing not to have with their parents, probably because they're very sensitive subjects, but I think that there needs to be parental involvement to ensure that they're being used appropriately. I also think that education and guidance around, you know, AI chatbots are probably not the best thing to use if this has to do with a physical or mental health issue. Let's get you professional help with someone who is licensed in the trade. And that AI, while it has its uses, this is not what it was intended for, and it can be dangerous.
Well, essentially, I think what you're suggesting is AI, just like a reference book in a library, can be a supplement, but not a substitute for care from a professional.
I think that's a great way of putting it. Yes.
So, in the future, this is just going to become more ingrained, Dr. Kohlhase, in all of our worlds. And it'll be different next year when we have this conversation. I believe because of new technologies that will present themselves to us in the coming year. What safeguards should we all consider? We've talked about that they're not a substitute, but again, from the parental perspective, there are histories available that you can look at a chatbot history, just like you can look at a Google search history. But I'm guessing that teens are smart enough to log in under a different account and show the parent one account and not the other. So how do we navigate what's coming at us?
Well, and the answer to this question may extend beyond the use of chatbots. I think it's just internet usage in general. I think that there need to be constant and ongoing conversations about safe usage. I think that understanding boundaries, making sure that kids are not giving out personal information, making sure that if they're being asked or given instructions to do something that doesn't feel right, regardless of the platform that's being used, right? Don't believe everything that you hear. Ask questions, go to a trusted adult, have a checkpoint, right? I think that the other piece of this is probably that you know, parents really just need to make sure that they're alert to signs that there is maladaptive use regardless of the content. So if kids are spending hours alone in their room, if they are using any kind of screen time as a substitute for real life activities, if they're withdrawing from friendships, from sports, from other activities, if they become irritable, if they lose interest in doing anything other than screen time, those are all red flags for screen use in general. And so I think that those are things that parents should be talking about and putting parameters in place if it seems like the use of the internet is escalating out of control.
So in your office, Dr. Kolhase, what are you seeing that you are attributing to a direct result of overuse of chatbots, overuse of social media, overuse of screen time?
I would say one of the first things is a decline in quality of real life relationships. So whether that's parents saying, I don't see my kid, you know, they're in their room. When they're not at school, they're in their room. Or we have huge behaviors and meltdowns and tantrums when I try to limit that. If I try to put boundaries around screen time, my child can't tolerate that. A decreased interest in, you know, somebody who typically is involved in sports but doesn't want to join teams because they'd rather be at home on a device. That's also a big concern. And I think that, you know, in conversations that I have with kids and teenagers who really don't want to talk about anything else, it's all consuming and it's almost like living in a fantasy world, right? We're not talking about interpersonal relationships. We're not talking about goals and hopes for the future. It's all about this game or this platform. That's very concerning. And it's something that I see a lot, particularly when kids are dealing with stressors. It's an escape, right? If I can just escape to this virtual world, I can forget about everything else.
So what's your role then in helping break that cycle?
Well, that's a tough one because I think that, you know, especially kids and teens, they can be very resistant to yet one more adult telling them they need to get off their devices. But I think, you know, to use kind of a clinical term, like motivational interviewing, what are your goals? What do you hope to do? Is it important to you to do well in school? You know, how can you manage your time? Is this something that you could make sure that you're doing your homework first? You know, do you value your relationships with parents and siblings? Let's set aside some time, make sure that you're spending a half hour an evening with them, you know, go to family dinners, getting them to think it's less about stop using screens and it's more about let's add some other things into your daily repertoire. We all know it's easier to add a habit than to stop a habit, right? And reframing it that way can also engender less resistance, I think.
Dr. Kolhase, do you think do you know enough to answer this question that the North Dakota schools bell to bell cell phone ban has made a difference?
You know, that's a really good question. And Craig, to be honest, I'm not sure. I haven't heard very much from students. I know that when that first, you know, came into effect, kids were pretty upset about it. I don't know how that's going. I think in theory, you know, it's a good idea to not have devices in the classroom if kids can't use them responsibly. Although I would much rather see the work done at home to teach kids responsible use of devices and to not have to have that in place. But that's also, you know, requiring a lot of parents, and not every family has the resources, the time, the capacity, or even the desire for those conversations. So that's a tricky one.
Wonder if it's just shifted the time that all of this communication online has happened to, like you suggested, in the bedroom with the doors closed, after school, into the night, without intervention from folks. Dr. Kolhase, it's always a pleasure. My guest is Dr. Alexandra Kolhase. She's with Essentia Health, where she's a clinical psychologist. And we've been talking about AI, teens, mental health, and the use of chatbots, things like ChatGPT, and its impact on their mental health. Happy New Year, Dr. Kolhase. Look forward to visiting with you more.
Thank you, Craig. Same to you.
Listening to Main Street on Member Supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Detheridge. Craig Blumenschein will be back in the hosting chair tomorrow. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll have a conversation with former NPR and national security correspondent Dina Temple Raston, who will premiere a brand new radio show on Prairie Public this coming weekend. It's called Click Here. It's all about technology, including things like we just heard about artificial intelligence. And we'll share another page-turning story from Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, The Tell. Hope you'll stay with us. Up next, it's Tom Ezern and his Plains Folk Essay. The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
Echoes of the Old Country, Growing Up German-Russian on the Northern Plains, by Jessica Clark, is a landmark work in German-Russian history published this year by North Dakota State University Press. The book launched to great acclaim at the meeting of the Germans from Russia Heritage Society last summer in Mandan. There, I picked up my autographed copy, which was, in a way, returning a favor. More than a decade ago, I signed the progenitor of Jess's work as director of her dissertation in history at NDSU. This is an association in which I take a great deal of pride and satisfaction. Since that earlier signature, Jess has been busy raising a family and making a career. Now she's provost of a large university in Washington State. Lately, too, she has suffered some personal hardship, which is on my mind as I review her book. Echoes of the Old Country, an oral history gathered from Germans from Russia in North Dakota, Saskatchewan, and neighboring territories, is, she says, a study of their childhood memories and ethnic identity, on their terms and in their words. Well, yes and no. There is an important dynamic that emerges in investigative oral history, the narrator interacting with the collector. For instance, in regard to childhood play and leisure, any old German-Russian will tell you, oh, we didn't have time to play. We had to work all the time. You know that isn't really true, right? But to get the story of play and leisure in German-Russian childhood, you have to hang around for hours, extend the conversation, break bread, drink coffee, and eventually your narrators will let slip some of the hijinks and frolics they enjoyed as kids, after the chores were done, of course. The book is also highly revisionist. The given narrative as to German-Russian kids and education, for instance, is that first, German-Russians despised learning, and second, the kids were traumatized by harsh measures taken in schools to promote assimilation. Well, in the first place, when you ask the kids now grown up themselves, many of them delighted in schooling and school activities. Moreover, the schools did not eradicate German-Russian ethnic identity. Instead, the experience, in Clark's words, reinforced their shared memory and identity, which was, after all, a changing identity through the second and third generations on the land here. The result was an adapted, new, but not diminished, German-Russian identity accounting for intergenerational change. For instance, I'm writing in the Christmas season, which puts me in mind of the traditional German-Russian Christmas ogre, the Belzenickel, who came to terrorize little boys and girls, sometimes even carrying them off in gunny sacks. Clark's chapter on German-Russian holidays, however, opens with an encounter with a kinder, gentler Belzenickel, sort of an amalgamation with the blessed Christkindl, who brings the children presents. Much credit goes to Michael Miller and his Germans from Russia Heritage Center for supporting Clark's far-flung collection of 199 priceless interviews with German Russians of the Northern Plains. Like Clark's book, those primary documents are a blessing to future generations of researchers and to the still vital German Russian community.
That was Tom Ezern in another wonderful Plains Folk Essay here on member-supported Prairie Public. It's Main Street. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenschein for one more day. He'll be back with you tomorrow. You can listen to a whole archive of Plains Folk Essays at prairiepublic.org or sign up for the Plains Folk Essay podcast wherever you get them. Well, on the way, have you ever had an enthusiastic biology teacher, one that gets excited about, oh, we'll say, dissecting frogs? Yeah, I sure have. And another story from Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, The Tell, one woman describes the impact a science teaching aunt had on her. But right now, let's get you up to date on some regional news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new North Dakota law that took effect January 1st makes it so health insurers must respond to prior authorization requests in a timely fashion. As Mike Moen reports, the changes follow reforms seen elsewhere in the country, and advocates hope they'll reduce treatment delays for patients.
Prior authorization involves a doctor seeking advance coverage approval of a medical treatment for their patient. The practice has become widespread as insurers try to contain costs. But physicians and health advocacy groups say it can be burdensome and disrupt care options. Fargo resident Emily Bockham testified in support of new state-level deadlines for insurers, saying they'll guarantee more timely access to treatment.
It's super important that there's some kind of consistency and that people aren't waiting.
Bockham was inspired to speak up in honor of her late cousin, whose care team ran into hurdles after a cancer diagnosis. Under North Dakota's new law, insurance plans have 7 calendar days to provide a decision for non-urgent prior authorization requests and 72 hours for urgent requests. The law received bipartisan support but saw pushback from the insurance industry, with lobbyists warning of unintended consequences. Republican Senator Scott Meyer sponsored the bill last session, and he says it was important to take a stand for patients. He also points to provisions that cover the review process for denials, keeping it largely in the hands of medical professionals rather than a business analyst. Some skeptics say these moves will push costs higher, but Meyer argues reducing administrative tasks will result in less stress on the system.
You know, you have doctors and others just chasing down prior authorization. When they're doing those types of things, there's a cost that comes with it.
AARP is part of a broad coalition supporting the new law, with the group praising the guardrails that were added. Essentia Health, which provides care in North Dakota, also backs the changes. It cites a 2023 survey from the American Medical Association revealing that physicians and their staff spent an average of 14 hours each week to complete prior authorization requests. 92% of physicians also reported seeing delays in care. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
And Congresswoman Julie Fedorchak has formally announced her campaign for re-election. She did so in a video posted to YouTube this morning.
In Congress, Julie is rolling back regulations to unleash North Dakota energy, eliminating subsidies for expensive and unreliable green energy, supporting businesses and families with the largest tax cut in history, strengthening Medicaid, supporting our farmers through crop insurance, risk management tools, and fighting for fair trade deals, securing our border, and passing laws like the Lake and Riley Act and Halt Fentanyl Act to save lives and keep us safe.
Fedorchak says she has the full support of President Trump for her re-election bid. She will likely have opposition at the state GOP convention to be held in March in Minot. Alex Balazs got the GOP congressional endorsement 2 years ago, but finished well behind Fedorchak in the primary. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Magazine, formerly North Dakota Horizons. For more than 50 years, the bi-monthly publication has been celebrating North Dakota's great people, places, food, events, and history. Subscriptions available at NorthDakotaMagazine.com. You are listening to Main Street on member-supported Prairie Public. Happy first Monday of 2026. Back to work, back to school for a lot of us. Well, on the subject of school, a storyteller from Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, The Tell, shares her memory of an infectiously curious biology teacher, one that she happened to be related to. Artificial intelligence, well, it's here to stay. You're interacting with it every day, whether you know it or not. Or, if you're like me, some of the lingo around AI makes your head spin and feel like you got a little bit of catching up to do as far as learning about the subject. Well, good thing we have a new program where AI is a prominent character along with other tech stories you don't need to be a techie to understand. Click here. Premieres Sunday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Central here on Prairie Public. And I'm very excited to welcome the show's host, a familiar voice, former NPR national security correspondent, Dina Temple Raston. Dina, hi.
Hi there.
Well, I was just listening to the investigative journalism program over the weekend, the Peabody Award-winning Reveal, and they were marking their 10th anniversary, and the host and producer noted how they didn't predict that the time the show was launched, that it would last very long just because of all the resources and time it took to put a weekly show like that together. So at the dawn of your new weekly radio show, Click Here, what are your goals and ambitions for both impact and longevity?
Well, as you said, technology is this thing that seems to be washing over people, and nobody bothers to try to explain what it is that's behind these technologies. They're kind of hiding behind the jargon. So what we're hoping to do is do for tech what Planet Money did for the economy or what Radiolab did for science, and just make it not just accessible, but fun. And there's a sense that people have lost agency because of all this jargon. Like, oh, what do I do with AI? It's head spinning. How do I respond? How do I make it part of my life or decide to not make it part of my life? Well, what we're hoping to do with Click Here is actually give you the tools you need to decide what kind of technology you want in your life. Because the digital world isn't really just about tech. It's about how technology is rewiring our lives and both these quiet and profound ways, and that's what we cover during the show.
Music is also a character in the show Click Here, as well as the conversations and content. Now, I could think about your pilot episode, which we're going to start with on the 11th. There are sounds of the humpback whale and Judy Collins meshing together to great effect. So sort of the sound effects and the sound design overall, it sounds very clandestine, very kind of cool. How would you describe, Dina, how music and sound design are key elements of Click Here?
Well, everyone who's part of the show is some sort of National Public Radio refugee, right? And in the old days of National Public Radio, This American Life, all these great shows that we mentioned before, Planet Money and things like Radiolab, sound design really makes things accessible, right? What we call it internally is there's lots of spinach in our shows, but you don't really realize that you're learning about how machine learning works or how, you know, cybersecurity is keeping hospitals safe. Instead, what you're getting is a narrative show, a yarn, not just two people talking, but instead like a whole story that you can follow. And you don't even realize that by the end of the story, we've taught you about how neural networks work, or we've taught you about, you know, how someone hacks into a system and what you can do to prevent it. The idea is to make this a super enjoyable show that leads with curiosity instead of all the jargon that seems to be out there to kind of cover up what tech is really doing.
Well, what I like, too, is like a good This American Life story, Radiolab story, or just a good book. You know, it's a page-turner. There are characters. There's protagonists and antagonists. And just when you think you're kind of warming up to the idea of AI, well, then, you know, AI is changing in a bad way the way weather is forecasted locally, you know. So it just has all these different layers of storytelling. And that all starts, of course, as you know, Dina, with excellent writing. And you've penned books along with lots of radio stories over the years. So describe how your writing style, how writing in general informs the storytelling here on Click Here.
Well, we're very writing forward on Click Here, right? There's so many tech shows that are out there right now that are just talking heads speaking in this sort of coded technology language. And so what we wanted to do is actually bring to public radio for the first time a tech show that anyone can listen to. Your kids will get into it. The whale story in the pilot, without giving too much away, is about how AI is helping researchers actually build a kind of Duolingo for whales. So we don't just have their songs, but maybe we can understand what they're saying. And if you can understand what a whale is saying, just think about what that might tell you about what's going on in the oceans that we don't know about. Maybe if we could decode what they're saying, they'd say, hey, look, it's not the propellers on the ships that are really bothering us or the warm water. It's all this plastic that we run into. So the idea is that all these different technologies can give us a new window into the world around us and even into ourselves. And that's what we're leaning into, not just with the writing, but with the sound, with the people we choose, you know, to be the characters who are vehicles for these stories. And again, what's great about it, or what we love about it and what we're trying to do, is actually not make this a show for techies, although techies will like it too. This is a show for people who want to understand what's going on in the world when it comes to the digital world. And we just make it easy to do that.
Well, great writing, sound design, storytelling, those are elements in Click Here and a good public radio show in general. But, of course, there's another element, and that is the human voice. And, Dean, I have to say there's always been something extra compelling for me as a listener about your voice, and this dates back to when you were the national security correspondent for NPR. Of course, you had lots of stories around 9/11 and things like the Patriot Act, and you know, it always make me lean in. So there's lots of credibility behind it, but I feel like you're telling me something that I should know, but maybe I'm not supposed to. No, it's not exactly Austin Powers, but I would call you an international woman of mystery. Now, English wasn't your first language, right? You were not born in the United States.
No, I'm actually Belgian, or at least I was born there. I have both passports. And French was my first language, but I feel like my English is really coming along.
Yeah, I'd say. Well, your voice and any of us in radio and audio storytelling have, a love-hate relationship with our own voices, but we have certainly worked hard to perfect that over the years. How have you?
I think what you try to do is the longer you've been in this, and now I've been, sort of doing radio for almost 25 years, is you just try to be yourself as much as you can be. And that's actually a lot harder to do that than you would expect. I'm a basically optimistic, curious person. And the show is, optimism and curiosity forward. And that's what we've been working on in the show from the beginning. It started out as a podcast 4 years ago. And we found an audience really quickly. We get about 200,000 downloads a month of people who are interested in tech, but have always been a little bit hesitant to know about it. I think that the other thing is when people hear my voice, because I was the terrorism correspondent for so long at NPR, people associated with me, particularly during the times of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they associated with me sort of bad news. If people heard me on Morning Edition, as soon as they said Dina Temple-Rustin has the story, they knew it was probably something that had something to do with an attack.
Guilty.
And I think with unfortunately. But, what ended up happening, though, is that what I ended up doing is explaining to people whether they needed to worry about an attack or not, whether it was something that was going to be, bigger than what it appeared, say, like the Boston Marathon bombings, which actually went on, if you recall, for about 2 weeks, or whether it was a one-off thing that, maybe the NYPD was able to stop in its tracks. And by being able to tell people how they should internalize these different attacks, I think it sort of gave them a bit of control. So it didn't seem like these attacks were something that they, would just wash over them. And this is the same thing that we have with tech, right? We keep hearing these scary stories about tech, but what you need is someone to sort of decode tech for you and say, look, this is kind of the worrisome part, and this is the part that has been exaggerated, and this is the part that's been hyped, and here is how this might fit into your life. This is how, say, for example, AI has gotten really good at reading mammograms, right? The x-rays of breasts looking for lumps or cancer or whatever it is. When I first got mammograms, it would take 2 weeks to get them, right? So they'd do the x-ray and then they'd say, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Now, it takes a couple of hours. By the time you get home from the doctor's office, you have the results on your desk. Why is that? Because of AI able to read these so well and flag something if it's a problem so that a human can read it. This is a really positive thing that AI is doing, but we don't hear as much about that. So we're trying to also bring those sort of happier stories about tech. We're not Pollyanna-ish, but we're trying to explain how tech can fit in a good way in your lives and how you can pick and choose these technologies to make your life easier.
Yeah, and getting the facts from a credible and reassuring voice, that's obviously a plus for a show like this for those that are tech curious, want to know more. But back to the dark side of things, Dina. We talked about the power of the human voice for connecting people to our medium. But you did pen a book a while ago about the Rwandan genocide and how radio, human voices on the radio, fueled that or helped fuel that. In this world of AI, how do you see the role of the voice as a force for good and evil?
For the most part, I see voice as a force for good, a force for connection. You know, we have a story that's in one of the shows that's coming up about a radio station in Ukraine called Radio Rocks. And it was the first sort of international hard rock and roll station in Ukraine that it has established itself. It was on, you know, every radio and every car in Ukraine. And then the war happened. And the managers of Radio Rocks decided that they needed to become something else. They needed to become a lifeline for people because with the electricity out, right, you were losing the internet, which is somebody's lifeline these days. But you could go into your car and find out, you know, where something had been bombed. You could hear from the front. You could request songs, you know, for your family who might be at home. And it brought this whole community together. One of the things about the war, the senior supervising producer, Sean Powers, and I both went to Ukraine at the beginning of the war and did a bunch of reporting there. And the whole thing that Vladimir Putin is trying to do is trying to break morale, right? And when you talk about radio and connection, what Radio Rocks was doing was being an antidote to that. So even with all this technology, I think what's great about voice is that it still adds this human element. It's obvious I'm not an AI voice. And we bring that human element to this thing that for a long time was just sort of a little distant from our humanity. We put the humanity back into tech.
And the old tech of radio is still very strong in a place like Ukraine, where it's definitely still very much needed. So I can't wait to hear that story. Now, I know that one other issue that you cover a lot and will cover, I imagine, are data centers. They're certainly a big issue here in North Dakota, as they are in many communities across the country. It seems like nobody really knows who's behind them. Civic leaders seem to be quick to roll out the red carpet, while residents tend to be a little more skeptical. There are NDAs, questions about resource hoarding and higher power bills for the rest of us. Now, you, Dina, wrote an article in Wired magazine a little while back about a Kentucky community that experienced a crypto mining boom and now maybe a bust. Do you know what's behind these new industries? Who are these people who are pulling the strings and benefiting?
Well, that's part of the problem, right? That these city councils who think that they're sort of going to glom onto the next wave of data centers and bring jobs into their communities have to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, so they can't even talk about who's coming in. We have another story in addition to the story on Kentucky crypto mining, which will be in an upcoming show, but we also have one about data centers, particularly one in Missouri that they wanted to bring in this data center. The city didn't even know who was behind it. And then this young college student decides, no, we're not going to let them do this. And he actually organizes the entire community in such a way that they actually are able to block the data center from coming into their community because of all the secrecy around it. Again, this gets to this idea that technology isn't something that you're kind of powerless to stop. You have lots of agency. All you need is the education and some data to be able to push your views forward. And that's what happened in this story. And it's actually something we try to do in every story instead of just doom and gloom, which I may be a little bit associated with because of the terrorism coverage I did. What we're trying to talk about is sort of the hopeful nuggets here that you might be missing, or the little bits of this that will allow you to be able to control the technology more than having the technology control you.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of the new weekly series, Click Here. The show is exciting and compelling. You had a mini-series of Click Here a little while ago, mostly about data security. I was absolutely riveted by it, so I'm very excited that we're going to be bringing this to Prairie Public's air on a weekly basis. It's a great listen. Congratulations on the big launch.
And thank you so much for being part of the original stations that have decided to air it. And I can tell you, it's going to be a really exciting year, in not just in terms of tech, but in terms of what we'll bring you from Click Here.
That's Dina Temple-Raston, host of Click Here, which we will premiere this coming Sunday at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public. Well, right now it's time for another live story from Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, The Tell. Here's Denise Johnson.
Come on, ride on the magic school bus.
I was
very fortunate growing up to kind of live a little bit of a feral childhood, shall we say, and had a lot of time spent with my grandparents and my aunt. My aunt, another one of those ladies who chose never to have children, but was a school teacher. And I'm pretty sure that Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus was modeled after my Aunt Dorothy. Because all of the things that Miss Frizzle did, my Aunt Dorothy would have loved to have done, and or maybe did some of those things if they were even remotely possible. So when I was a little girl, she brought home a kitten and handed it to me and said, "Go ask your mom if you can keep it." Okay. She also, when the neighbor lady would come over and I was just learning to talk, she also taught me to say, when you answer the door, "Mommy is a harlot." Okay. So a little bit of a feral childhood, right? So when we were, you know, growing up, she would always be game to do whatever we could dream up. She would chase us around the yard pretending to be a monster in the night, playing night games. She would take us swimming at the lake whenever we asked, even if it hadn't been an hour after dinner. She was always game to do anything. And she always had us outside, and she loved nature. She was a science teacher, and biology and everything were her favorites. And she would take us down. My grandparents lived on a river, and so we had kind of a little swampy area. And she'd take us down to the swamp, and she's like, "Let's go to the swamp." And we'd go to the swamp, and we'd catch tadpoles, and we'd put them in an old bathtub that was out in the yard at my grandparents' house, and we'd watch the tadpoles grow into frogs, and then we'd go release them back at the swamp. She'd take us out walking in the woods, and, you know, we're 3 and 4 years old, and she'd be like, "Okay, what's that animal? Is that an omnivore? Is that an herbivore?" And she would teach us family, genus, species of every single plant out there. And so she'd look at us and say, "What is that? Family, genus, species." And so she was our very own Miss Frizzle. And when Miss Frizzle came out, I was pretty sure that they had modeled Miss Frizzle after her, because she looked like Miss Frizzle. Big, wild, curly hair. She couldn't match her clothes to save her life. She couldn't cook. We'd gone to her house for dinner one time, and my brother says, "What is this in my mouth?" She couldn't cook spaghetti. Now, my mom tries to say that it was just because Chase couldn't remember what spaghetti was. I'm not buying it. It was pretty bad. But she would do crazy things. She would stop along the road and pick up roadkill and soak it in formaldehyde so that her classes could put the bones back together like a puzzle. She would start every year of school by jumping on top of her lab tables and saying, "All right, let's get high on science." Okay. That's just the person she was. And so, bigger than life personality. You know, she had a student bring a fish that he had gotten, he'd speared ice fishing, brought this fish to her, and when he was cleaning the fish, he found a whole frog hibernating inside the fish's belly, and he thought it was so cool, he drove it to her house and shows her this frog in the fish's belly. And she looks at it and she says, "Oh my gosh, I think this frog is still alive." And so she takes the frog out of the hibernation sack that it's in, and she puts it in an aquarium in her basement, and the frog lives. And she named him Jonah. So Jonah, of course, she thought Jonah was very lonely. So every spring, she'd go out into any swamp she could find looking for a girlfriend for Jonah, because Jonah was awfully lonely in that aquarium. She had a rattlesnake skeleton in the outhouse at her yard, right? So she was a bigger than life personality. And then tragically, she developed frontal lobe dementia. And we saw that bigger than life personality change to somebody who didn't know who we were, couldn't have a conversation, wasn't able to speak. She went the last years of her life without being able to speak to any of us. But she knew who we were and would hold our hands. And so someday, I hope that I get to go on a ride on her magic school bus once again and meet my very own Miss Frizzle.
That's Denise Johnson sharing her very personal story about her biology teaching aunt, a very important person in her life. The Tell is Alive monthly storytelling event takes place at the 4 and 4 in downtown Fargo. That's right above Side Street Grill and Pub. The next one is coming up Thursday, January the 8th. That's this Thursday at 7 p.m. You can check out more info on The Tell's Facebook page and Instagram. Well, hi, I'm Eric Dethridge, Program Manager at Prairie Public. With the new year comes some changes to our radio lineup I'd love to tell you about. Starting Sunday, January 11th at 7 p.m. Central, we're very excited to welcome a program about technology you don't have to be a techie to understand. Click Here, hosted by former NPR National Security Correspondent Dina Temple-Raston.
Consider the data center, the single biggest driver of all these rising emissions.
One of Google's data centers was called Lord Voldemort because it was like he who shall not be named.
We do not speak his name.
Our weekly showcase of astonishing performances from outstanding young classical musicians from the top moves to 8 p.m. Central on Sunday nights.
It's like a very cliche, like, as a home, I was in the living room and then like a recording comes, like, Mom, I want to play the violin now.
Wow. So then, and who knows who might be listening to you right now and saying to their mom, I want to play the violin so I can sound like Laura.
Please welcome for the first time to the Mountain Stage, Top House.
And 2 hours of live performances from Mountain Stage will now kick off at 9 p.m. Find out more about what's playing and when on the listen page, prairiepublic.org. That's it for Main Street on this Monday, the first one of 2026. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'm Eric Dethridge. It's been my pleasure sitting in for Craig Blumenschein for the last week or so. Craig will be back tomorrow with you, so I hope you'll join him at 3 and 7 p.m. Central. All Things Considered is up next if you're listening during the afternoon broadcast. If you're listening tonight, stay tuned for Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam. And thanks, as always, for listening to Prairie Public.